Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about home insemination with donor sperm. But before we get there, I have a favor to ask. I want you to tell your friends about this podcast. You are the best source that we have for spreading the word. We have the number one ranking in iTunes for this subject area, and we want to keep it. And iTunes uses rankings and ratings and numbers of people who subscribe. We would really appreciate it if you would tell others. And if you're listening and you haven't subscribed, do us a favor and subscribe. Today, we're going to be talking about home insemination with Corey Burke. He is Tissue Bank Director and Executive Vice President of Cryos International USA. Welcome, Corey, to Creating a Family.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
We always enjoy, even you and I see each other at conferences, and I thoroughly enjoy talking to you, both in person and on air. So I've been looking forward to this.
Great. It's always a pleasure to speak with you as well.
Well, home insemination is a topic that we get a lot of questions on, and there is so much misinformation out there. How would there be information if you think about it? This is not something that you necessarily grow up knowing about or hearing about, but there's a lot of misinformation. So I'm really thankful we're using this as this time to talk about it. All right, let's start off with just some real basics here. We need to understand the different terms we're going to be using. First of all, there's the term artificial insemination. And then there's another term that a lot of people have heard, which is intrauterine insemination, also known as IUI. And then there is intracervical insemination, which a lot of people have not heard of, and that's ICI. So if you wouldn't mind, just walk us through what all three of those are.
Okay. ART in general speaks of any terms of assisted reproductive technology. So that covers the gamut from inseminations to IVF to anything related to the field of assisted reproductive technologies. So then the other two things that you mentioned, ICI and IUI, are kind of the more specific things that are really relative to the home and sim conversation. The IUI is intrauterine insemination, and that's when we actually, let me back up a little bit. If you go to the doctor to have the procedure done, they will generally do an IUI on you, and they'll place a catheter in through the cervix into the uterus and inseminate you into the uterus directly. The specimen that we provide for IUI is a little different than the specimen that we provide for ICI.
We're gonna come to that in just a minute.
We'll get to that in just a minute. Yeah. So the other one is intercervical insemination. And that's one that you can do at home. So you don't need to go through the cervix. It's intercervical, but it's actually really vaginal insemination, mm-hmm. Much like home, just like natural insemination would be. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And another term that's used is artificial insemination. Where does that fit in?
You know, that's one of those catch-all phrases. Again, it just depends on who you're talking to as to what does artificial insemination mean. Again, that can go back to ART. It can be, it can be artificial insemination could happen in the laboratory with IVF, or it could be using sperm, either your husband's or your donor sperm to inseminate you with. It's just a process of taking the sperm out or collecting the sperm, processing the sperm and putting it back in.
Okay, gotcha. So those are the terms we're going to use. And just to sum up, intracervical insemination, also known as ICI, mm-hmm. is what we're talking about with home insemination.
Yes.
And almost always IUI, intrauterine insemination, is what happens in a doctor's office.
Yes.
All right. So those are the two things we're going to be contrasting today. Mm-hmm. Because when people think of using donor sperm, most people think of IUI. They think of going to a doctor and utilizing it through oil or utilizing it with IVF as well. Yeah. So that's what most people think about. But today we're going to be talking about another option, which is home insemination utilizing ICI. Mm-hmm. First of all, let's talk about the difference in sperm that is used. And we're really thinking more of donor sperm, although you're right, in particular with IUI, you can use your partner, if your partner is male, sperm. So let's talk about, though, for donor sperm, what is the difference in sperm that is used for either intracervical ICI or interuterine IUI insemination?
Okay. And that's a great question, because that we do get a lot of questions about that. And it is a simple process, but a lot of people just don't understand the difference. So we'll start with IUI. So we'll take a specimen, a semen specimen, we collect the specimen, we run it through a process where we spin it down in a centrifuge using a gradient that separates the sperm, it takes the dead sperm out, it takes all the cellular content out, it takes the semen off of it, and leaves us with a specimen of pure sperm. We then add some media to that sperm to concentrate it to whatever number of sperm we want in the sample, and then we add some cryoprotectant and freeze it. So that would be an IUI specimen. It's just kind of a much cleaner specimen. And lots of times when I say it's a cleaner specimen, that concerns people. They say, okay, well, the other one's dirty. I'm concerned about that. But I don't mean it like that. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by that. So when we process an IUI specimen, we take all of the things out, including the prostaglandins that are in the semen. So it is a cleaner specimen. You can use it in a laboratory. You can fertilize eggs with it. But more importantly, you can place it in the uterus, and the uterus doesn't have any real issues with it. But if you put prostaglandins into the uterus, you can cause the uterus to contract, and then it really doesn't do a lot of good to put the sperm in the uterus if it contracts and squirts it back out. So the big difference is with the IUI sperm, it is very clean and pure sperm. We have basically just motile sperm, nothing dead, 100% viable sperm until we freeze it, then some of it dies, and then it's a different story. But it's still a very pure specimen.
Is it more concentrated?
Yes, it is more concentrated, because we've removed all of the other materials in the sperm, and it's just left with sperm. So it is more concentrated. So when we end up with at the end of the process, we end up with a test tube, and at the bottom of it, we'll have just a little dot of sperm, millions and millions of sperm. And then we can dilute that specimen to whatever concentration that we want to end up with.
Okay.
With ICI sperm, it's basically raw sperm. All we do is take the sperm, we add cryoprotectant to it, and we freeze that sperm. So it is, again, using the terms dirty and clean, it's not dirty. It's just not a clean specimen like we say with an IUI specimen.
So it has what are the other stuff when a man ejaculates, mm-hmm. what comes with, obviously there's sperm in the ejaculate, yes. but what else comes with that?
Well, again, the big thing that we're interested in that is a big constituent of it is prostaglandin. So the prostate produces most of the semen that you get in an ejaculate. The sperm is a very small part of that process. The semen actually contains sperm. So a lot of people confuse that fact as well. Semen is not sperm. Sperm is sperm. Sperm is part of semen.
Yeah, you're right. That is another common misconception.
Yeah, you're absolutely. So it is much more concentrated when we get a finished product.
Okay. So in natural conception, where a man and a woman are having sex, mm-hmm. the man ejaculates, the ejaculate is it approaches the cervix.
Yes.
The cervix filtering is probably not the right word, but in essence, the prostaglandins, the dead sperm, everything stays on the yes. vaginal side, and only live motile sperm will make it through the cervix into the uterus. That's how it normally happens, right?
Sort of. Yeah, there's a whole process to it. When a man ejaculates, it's very viscous and thick. So you have a very thick ejaculate. After a certain amount of time, that actually starts to liquefy. So it becomes very fluid. So if you actually collected it in a cup, you would see that it's a very thick specimen. You wait 20 minutes, a half hour to an hour, it starts to liquefy. And now it's very watery. It's totally different consistency than when it came out. Same thing that it does in the vagina. It's probably a physiological byproduct of holding the sperm together where it needs to be until the sperm can swim out of the actual ejaculate into the mm-hmm. uterus. And the prostaglandins are a big part of that as well. Prostaglandins actually aid the sperm in getting into the cervix and through the cervix.
Okay. Do you have to use unwashed sperm for an ICI?
No, you can use either one. And it was interesting that you, in the beginning, when you talked about the, you know, what we know about this sort of process. And, you know, most of what we know about IUI, ICI, it comes from IUI because it's been studied in doctor's offices, and we know exactly the process. Well, I don't use process. We know the process, but we don't know some of the details about ICI specimens and how it actually responds in the vagina and how people get pregnant in that fashion. But we've done much more studies in general with IUI specimens than we have ICI specimens.
Well, except for ICI is mimicking what happens naturally. So
yes, and that's the assumption, obviously. I mean, we're putting sperm in there. It's following the natural progression, but we don't know certain things. Like, you know, there have been a lot of studies about exactly how many sperm does it take to get somebody pregnant. It's easy to do with a doctor's office when we can control everything and do it. It just hasn't been that much research on it in the real world as far as vaginal insemination goes. Although we know it works, obviously. That's, we got plenty of kids running around from natural and donor inseminations. So we know it works. We just don't know all the details of how it works. And we have this discussion a lot. I talk to a lot of andrologists, and this is something we talk about often. The similarities between IUIs and natural insemination or home insemination.
Okay. So it is from a donor sperm standpoint, mm-hmm. you have already tested, so you know that there's the motility, you know, the sperm analysis for the sample, whether or not it's been washed or unwashed. Is
absolutely
that correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So you know that what you're going to be yeah. able to know how many motile sperm are in whether yeah. it's washed or unwashed. All right. Can you get both washed and unwashed donor sperm?
Yes, at least with our sperm bank, and I think most sperm banks are a similar situation, but we offer both. And so, usually from the same donor, you can get both types of sperm.
Oh, okay. So how often would it happen that somebody chooses a donor and then finds out that they only have IUI sperm or ICI sperm?
It happens. I can't tell you how often it happens, but I know that it does happen. I know that some of the more popular donors, you know, they sell out. We try to make a plan for collection, so we know what we need to produce based on sales. But sometimes we don't know that, and people end up having to use, or not having to use, but using IUI instead of ICI sperm. Mm-hmm. And we don't really see that it makes a whole lot of difference, but we do feel that ICI is a better specimen for the home insemination people.
Okay, well, you just answered my next question. Does it matter from a success standpoint?
Yeah, and I will caveat that by saying that is my opinion. But we really don't know. Is IUI sperm any different or better or any worse for home insemination? We don't know. We know that both work. So my opinion is, yes, because of the prostaglandins and other things that you find in the ICI specimens, that they are probably better for home insemination.
Is there a difference in cost? I'm thinking that there's less processing for a unwashed sample, but is there a difference in cost?
Yeah, there is a cost. It's slightly cheaper to get the ICI specimens because there's not as much labor involved in producing the specimen.
Gotcha. All right, now we're going to talk about shifting a little more to the actual home insemination. What are some of the benefits of home insemination? What are some of the reasons that people might choose to use home insemination versus an IUI?
Sure. And, you know, it's a tricky question because being in the IVF business, you know, it's tricky to recommend this and say that it is a good thing, because I know some of the doctors don't like that. They prefer to do inseminations in the office. But, you know, the fact is today we're much different than we were 10 years ago. We have a lot of same-sex couples. We have a lot of single women who want to be pregnant. We have a lot of people who don't have fertility problems. You know, they don't have a problem getting pregnant. Their biggest factor is they don't have sperm, which is a fertility issue. If you don't have any sperm, you can't get pregnant. So, you know, we found that there is lots and lots of people out there in the world that they just don't need to see the doctor. And I'll say again with this, I always suggest to people see the doctor before they attempt getting pregnant to make sure they're healthy enough to carry and maintain and have a baby. But, you know, it's every day people reproduce naturally and they don't see a doctor before they do it or during they do it. You know, they see it when they get pregnant, they have to see a doctor, but they don't see them in the buildup to it unless they have a fertility issue. And that's for me, the biggest thing with home insemination is that we allow a lot of people to actually do the process without having to cost a lot of money to do the process. You know, it's as difficult as reproduction can be. I always have to say it's just reproduction. It's simple. You know, it very much is simple, and we don't need to complicate it more than it is. Mm-hmm. So with a healthy woman who has no fertility issues, it's just a very convenient and friendly thing for them to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I would also add intimacy and privacy, and those, and I mean those as different things. It's you're not having to involve. Let me talk about the intimacy. It is, and it can become a part of an intimate act, and then we see this probably more often in same-sex, I mean, lesbian mm-hmm. couples. But even if you're doing it for for the most part, if the husband was infertile, there does have it's a, for lack of a better word, it's a lack of medicalization of a natural process, and it's also more private. You know, if this is between you and the sperm bank, and that's it, you're not having to involve anybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, and honestly, it can fit better into your schedule. You don't have doctor's appointments. You can work it around. Well, we're going to talk about it in a minute. You have to work it around your ovulation window, but nonetheless, it's your schedule as to when you're doing it, not a doctor's office. So there's that.
That's a great point because I mean, you know, for years I've been in doctor's office and I know how kind of unfriendly it is to come in and be inseminated. You know, it does lack that privacy. It does lack that mm-hmm. intimacy that you have otherwise. So those are very good points.
What about the cost of the actual procedure of an IUI? Because that's also money you're saving. Not only you save a little bit on the sperm, but you do save the entire cost of the medical procedure. So do you have an idea of about how much that costs?
You know, it just depends, anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 or so, just mm-hmm. for the IUI process itself. Mm-hmm. And it depends if you're taking medicine, you know, that can be much higher if you're taking, you know, ovulatory medicine or something of that nature.
But that would not be in this case. Home insemination is not for people who are taking ovulatory stimulation.
Yeah, home insem, they don't need that. They don't have the problem getting pregnant. Obviously, if you have a fertility issue, that may be something that you need, but not for home insem. That's not a topic really.
So, what are some of the disadvantages of home insemination?
That's a great question too. You know, I think it's...
Well, I'll tell you one you just mentioned before, and I'll sum it up, and that is, if you have a diagnosis or you think you will have a diagnosis of infertility, which goes along with age, you may not want to lose the time of a couple of months if you're older or you already know you have fertility issues.
Yes. No, that's a good point. Yes.
Yeah. That's one you had said earlier.
Yeah. And, you know, I think more issues, more downsides come from operator error, if you will, you know, not being able to remove the sperm and inject it into the vagina. That could be an issue with patients because, you know, if you do that, you've kind of lost your chance for that month. But, you know, otherwise, I don't really see any major downfalls to doing it. As long as it's done safely and using a sperm bank. Remember, you know, there is a big gray market out there for sperm, and that does concern me, that a lot of people use people that, you know, they just find them on, well, I don't know if Craigslist is around anymore, but they find them on whatever list and they buy sperm from people. But, you know, they don't know what they're buying necessarily. And there's a lot of safety that we look into. You know, we check genetics, we check infectious disease, we check family history. We know every product that we're putting out the door is good, safe sperm, and there's no problem with using it. And, you know, we do have some concern with the gray market. And it's not because they're competition for us. They're certainly not. But it's just the health issues that go along with it. It's very, very risky. And to be honest with you, I don't know how much money you save on it because the cost of home insemination is fairly low. It's not that expensive to do home insemination. And I just, it baffles me that somebody would just take somebody they meet on Craigslist or wherever and get sperm from them and inseminate themselves with it. And it's just, to me, is very odd.
There's a lot of unknowns that you're, a lot of risk you're taking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is the success rate? I guess the ultimate question that we all care about, if you're using donor sperm, is success. You're trying to get pregnant. So what are the success rates for intracervical insemination, in other words, home insemination, compared to IUI, intrauterine insemination?
Well, they're very close, probably around 20% for both. It's about 20% for IUI, and home insemination is a little lower. It's probably around 17%. I'm not sure if there's a statistical significance between 15 and 20%. There may be or may not be, but they're pretty close together with the two of them. And then we go back to the success rate with the IUI. Remember, most of the people having IUIs do have some fertility issues, so that can skew the results a little bit. We don't know about that. So,
that's a good point. Yeah, that's a very good point.
And that's been a big problem with it. You know, when I talked about results and comparing IUIs and that stuff, you know, it's a whole nother thing to compare intravaginal inseminations to IUIs for that reason alone, because most people who are having IUIs done have at least a male fertility problem, but they may have something of their own that also is skewing the numbers.
Right. Yeah. And again, then the older the woman, the more likely that is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes. Younger, you know, I talk to people all the time, and we'll have the late 20s or early 30s, and they get pregnant very easily. And then I'll have older women, and they're, you know, well, I'm not getting pregnant. Well, I hate to tell you, but it's because you're older and it's going to take a little bit longer, but you know, hopefully we'll still get you there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Let me pause for a moment to say that this show is sponsored by organizations who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. And they believe in our mission, and then they put their money where their mouth is. They help support our mission. Two such organizations I want to tell you about. One is Cryos International. Cryos International Sperm and Egg Bank is dedicated to providing a wide selection of high-quality, extensively screened, frozen donor sperm and eggs from all races, ethnicities, and phenotypes for both home insemination and fertility treatment. Cryos International is the world's largest sperm bank and the first freestanding independent egg bank in the United States, helping to provide the gift of family. Another organization is Walgreens and Alliance Rx Walgreens Prime. They provide specialized fertility pharmacy services through an experienced care team available 24/7 devoted to helping patients achieve successful outcomes. They understand the importance of timing and the need for personalized treatment, and they are committed to compassionate care and support throughout a patient's journey. All right, so we've talked about some of the advantages and disadvantages. So from your position, because you see who is opting to do home insemination over IUI, who do you see? What is the demographics of the people who are more likely to choose home insemination?
You know, it's rapidly changing. You know, we started seeing a lot of lesbian couples or same-sex couples some time ago when marriages or same-sex couples became more acceptable in society. So they've been like our primary target, or not target, but our primary customer for home insemination. But over the years, we've actually seen it also start developing into more single women. Single women now are going, hey, I'm working a job all the time. I'm not finding a mate. I need to get pregnant. I need to do this. I want to get pregnant. So we're starting to see a lot of single women who are joining the crowd. And then we're actually seeing a lot of, oddly enough, since the COVID thing has come out in the last couple of months, we've seen a lot of major increase in home insemination. And I think that's due in part to people not being able to, or not wanting to go to the doctor's office to do it. I think we've picked up a little bit of business because of the COVID situation.
Interesting.
We're not currently taking donors in due to the COVID, but we are still open for sales and we are still doing sales. So we have no problem with the sperm that we have. But I think that's our biggest market. So I think we're starting to see people, you know, if it's a heterosexual couple, they go to the doctor, they find out that they have a problem with just the sperm. The husband is azeospermic, doesn't have any sperm. Then they don't have any other confounding reproductive problems. Then they're starting to become looking to us and doing home insemination versus going to the doctor and having IUIs done in-house.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we see, and it's been an interesting shift. Home insemination is really for younger women because the reality is that older women are going to be more likely to have additional fertility issues,
right,
and they might benefit from IUI, the bypassing of the cervix. And, you know, we could debate on how much of a benefit it is, but for the most part, it's generally been assumed that younger women. So for a while, and this has been changing over the last 10 years, but lesbian couples were waiting to be older. They were older when they decided to try to start having kids. But we're seeing that shift now where younger lesbian couples are now having children. And so it seems like for them, it's the perfect option because they don't have any reason to believe they have fertility issues. They don't have, age has not been a problem for them. So that's worked out well. How about with your single women? Are you seeing that single moms by choice are coming in younger now so that home insemination is a really good option for them?
Yeah, I think it's a difference in society versus years ago. I think that, you know, it's more acceptable. And I think it's part of the fact that we've seen lesbians doing this for a long time. They've been able to do it. They've been doing it. But I think it's also transferred over to single mothers. You know, now it's not out of the social norm to mm-hmm. have a child when you're a single mother. And that age has gotten younger. I mean, it used to be, okay, they waited so long, they want to have a child. They're now, you know, late 30s, 40s, whatever. They didn't have a child. They regret that not having a child. But I think now we accept the fact that a young single woman can have a child. And I think it's just become a more social norm. And I think that we're definitely seeing an increase in younger single mothers coming in.
Yeah. I was wondering if that is a trend, and it makes sense because it's following the trends we've seen in other demographics.
It absolutely is. And I mean, you know, honestly, the way we've come about getting to where we are with same-sex couples has impacted all of society. It's not just mm-hmm. the same-sex couples, but again, like you said, it's making people feel confident about doing it if they're single mothers at a younger age than they once did. And I do, I really think that it is a part of the fact that society accepts same-sex couples in a much better fashion than we did, you know, years ago, not even that long ago, but, you know, just in recent history, we were less acceptive of same-sex couples.
Well, and I think we also are getting the message out mm-hmm. to everyone that time is not on your side, and that if you want to have a family, you know, you can't wait forever. And so I think that realization is we have made an impact there. And I think that is also a result than you would have single women saying, you know what, I'm 34. I don't see myself, you know, I'm not finding guys. And even if I do, then they can accept me and my child. So,
and I think that's been a benefit for the entire IVF industry. I have people ask me all the time, is infertility more common today than it was 20 years ago? And, you know, my answer is no. There was still exactly pretty much the same amount of infertility 20 years ago. But the thing is, we know about it. You know, it's out mm-hmm. there. There's mm-hmm. there's same-sex couples having babies. There's, you know, movie stars, rock stars that are having children in their 50s because of IVF. You know, and I think it's just that, you know, you've been around long enough to know that, you know, back in the day, people would sneak into practices because they were concerned about people knowing that they were having help having a child. And it's mm-hmm. not that way anymore. It's just become something more of a social norm that we're not concerned about. And, you know, we're not embarrassed by doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the same with single motherhood.
Yep, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. So now let's talk about the process for a woman or a couple who is considering home insemination. The first thing is to select a donor. So is there anything different that they would need to consider, or how do people go about selecting a donor? That's a little outside of the scope of home insemination, but it is the first step.
No, it is the first step, and it's probably the trickiest step. And I will tell you, selecting a donor, there's no magic trick to it. it's all about your desires, what you like and what you want. But you would be amazed at our client services. That's what they, all day long, they're having phone calls from people wanting to order sperm. They're asking a million questions about the sperm donor. You know, what have they had pregnancies? You know, do they do this? Do they play the trombone in the band? You know, they all want to know all sorts of things. So I can't tell you any particular thing that people look for in a donor or any secret to selecting a donor. It's just about you. It's what you want. It's what you desire in a partner to create a child with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then there's another thing about whether it's identified or anonymous. Yes. And I think we're certainly seeing an increase in a realization that for the child, that's another factor that a lot of people consider.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a huge factor. And that's another thing that's changed over the years. And again, it's because it's become socially acceptable to have a sperm donor. And, you know, before we used to hide the fact that we had a sperm donor, and some couples didn't want to tell their children that they were created from a sperm donor. But yeah, the choice of anonymous versus non-anonymous or open ID or whatever you want to call it, that is a factor. And, you know, I think that there's been a push. You know, there's definitely a push in the United States to go non-anonymous. And I'll first say this. There is no such thing as anonymous sperm donor anymore.
I was just going to say, the biggest change
blew that away.
I was going to say, over-the-counter genetic testing has changed. I would like to say it's because we've tried to educate people on the importance for children, because we've listened to the donor-conceived community. But in fact, it's been genetic testing that has shifted things.
That has been exactly what did it. You know, donor testing is what did it. But even before the donor testing was available, there was a push to start to non-anonymized donors. And, you know, I think that in cryos, we have, I think about 70% of our donors are non-anonymous. So they are ID released when they're 18. So if, when the child hits 18, they can find out who the parent was, make contact if they want to. And to be honest, I don't know how many we sell. I mean, we certainly sell some in the US, but, A lot of the anonymous sperm is used in other countries where it's required to be anonymous, which is quite the opposite of what we have in the U.S. You know, there's
that
a big
so
push to be non-anonymous, but there's countries that, you know, if you were to go to the doctor, you wouldn't be allowed to pick your sperm. The doctor would actually pick the sperm donor for you, and you would just take the sperm and get pregnant. And in other places, you do get to pick, but again, it's anonymous.
Which countries require anonymity? I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I do know some. I believe Poland is one of them.
Interesting.
I may be incorrect in that, but
there
are a number of European countries that do require anonymous sperm, and it's actually becoming very interesting because there's a big divide between them. Some of the countries in Europe are absolutely 100% non-anonymous donors. That's what they require.
Yeah,
that's what they have.
Exactly.
And then there's other ones, like I said, and I do believe Poland is one of them, where it is strictly anonymous. You can't know what it is. You can't know about the donor.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay.
Which seems awful to me, but yeah, you know, it's just the way they work.
You know, it's different strokes for different folks. And the more realistically, actually, I believe that it is better to have identified so that the child has that information. However, the reality is different countries feel differently, and there's not a darn thing that we can do that's going to change it. So,
exactly. Well, we work on changing it. Maybe someday we'll get things changed. But
From your position, that's true. You could do that. All right. So selecting a donor, then the next step is determining when you ovulate, because it doesn't do you any good to do any form of insemination without knowing if that, other than timing it during your fertile times. Right. So how would somebody go about it? I think most people now, it's interesting. Most people now just assume they have to buy an ovulatory predicting kit. But in fact, there are other ways. That is one way to do it, but there are other ways a woman can determine when she is most fertile.
Yeah, certainly the LH change, the ovulation kit, is the number one way to tell where you're ovulating. And that's pretty concrete. That gives you the results that you're looking for. But, you know, taking things like your basal temperature, that's a way of doing it. It's a little more complicated, and you assume that you're right when you hit a certain temperature. You can monitor the cervical mucus. That's a good way of doing it, but it's also a little tricky. I don't know why it's tricky, but some people find it very difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I feel the best way is the urine kits that detect ovulation.
Well, and you're also spending money on sperm. So It's one of those, as opposed to if you were just having sex at home, there's less monetary outlay. So, yeah, absolutely. So there may be, you may want to go over and above, even if the others are effective, you may want the added assurance.
Yes. Yeah. It's the gold standard, so to speak, is the ovulation test. So.
Okay. So now you know when you're ovulating and you've picked a sperm. How do you get, first of all, can sperm be shipped directly to your home?
Yes, it can. We ship every day. We ship stuff to people's homes. It comes in a nice little kind of vacuum container that we fill with liquid nitrogen. It has a absorbent material in it that absorbs some of the liquid nitrogen. So there's actually no liquid nitrogen in it. It's just very, very, very cold. We ship it to your house. We have shippers that last 5 days, and we have one that lasts 12 days. So you can pick your tank based on your predicted ovulation. So a lot of people know exactly when they're going to ovulate if they've done it more than once. So they know this particular day in the month, I'm going to ovulate, no problem. They know they're going to do it that day. So they get a small tank. They don't have to worry if something goes wrong and they don't ovulate. And other people will choose a larger tank to ship it in so that if they don't ovulate on, they may have a range of days that they ovulate. So they may ovulate between day whatever and day whatever. And the larger tank allows them to keep the specimen for longer.
Well, and let me point out that you raise a good point that when doing this, it makes very good sense to have at least tracked your ovulation for a couple of months so that you are learning your own cycle, because again, you're spending money on the sperm. Yep. So you want to know. All right. So how do you have to be at home when the shipment arrives?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that, but I believe it goes by FedEx, and I don't know if I know they used to require a signature, but now with the COVID stuff, they're not requiring signatures necessary. I think that you do have to be home though.
Okay. So
that's a great question, and one that you would think I would know, but.
Well, I didn't tell you I was going to ask it. So there you go.
Yeah. It's just one of those many things that I do know, but I can't remember the answer to be honest with you.
So you would need to either have it arrive on a day that you're going to be there or arrange for somebody. It's no different from any other thing that's going to be shipped to your house that needs a signature. Yeah. So, or shipped to your apartment that needs a signature. So the same way you handle one, you can handle the other.
And the good thing about it, when we ship it, it's not in something that you would identify as having sperm in it.
You just read my question.
So we don't want to have anybody advertising, hey, we have sperm sitting on our doorstep. So, you just receive a nice yellow container. It doesn't look like anything out of the ordinary. And most sperm banks use something similar. It doesn't come in a big package with sperm on the outside or saying sperm banks or anything like that.
Is it cold? I mean, if you have your doorman sign for you, is it going to be one of those that it's going to be freezing? And so he's going to know it's some type of cryopreserved something?
No, it's inside we put the tank that we put it in inside another shipping container that's padded and well insulated. So when FedEx drops it off their conveyor belts and that sort of stuff, it doesn't break. The package outside is certainly not cold. The actual inside is not cold either until you open it. And the part where we actually put the sperm inside the tank is cold, but the outside of the tank should not be cold.
So how long do you have after it arrives before you have to use it?
Well, again, that goes back to the size tank that you got. So, it starts with the day that we ship it. It takes a day to get there. So you have a few days with a small tank. You probably have 3 days and maybe a little bit more, but that's what we guarantee. With the larger tank, you have, like I said, 12 days and, which gives you a wide kind of variety. You should be able to use it in 12 days. That's almost a half a month of time. And hopefully you will ovulate before then and can use the product before it goes bad.
So the size of the tank means how much cold is surrounding the sperm.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I guess I should have specified that, but yeah.
Yeah. So you've got the liquid nitrogen. So that's the, and if you need it for a longer period of time, you need to have more cold surrounding the vial because the sperm is in the same size thing. Yeah.
And we've had situations arise where somebody just didn't ovulate 1 month and, you know, they've said, well, I'm not ovulating. What can I do? And of course they can send the sperm back to us. And usually there's enough time on the tank that they can get it back to us and we can put it in storage for them for the following month.
Oh, okay. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah. All right. So, so then your sperm is shipped. So how do you thaw sperm?
Well, all the banks vary a little bit. So we are actually the only bank in the United States that I know of that uses straws versus vials. Most of the other banks use vials.
Wait, what's the difference between a straw and a vial?
All right. I was going to tell you that. That was going to be my next statement. Okay. So we use vials or straws for a reason because straws are, so if you can imagine a coffee stir, I don't even know if they make coffee stirs anymore, but you know, the little straw that you stir your coffee
with. Yeah.
That's basically what it looks like, but it's made out of high resin, some sort of plastic that freezes well and doesn't break. But the advantage to using the straw is that it's long. And it doesn't hold that much in the center of the straw. So when you warm it with our specimens, you can just place it on the countertop for 15 minutes. It will warm up, it warms evenly, and there's no problem to it. With vials are still good. I mean, they still do a good job of storing sperm. They work very, very well. But the difference with them is when you freeze and thaw the sperm, it starts freezing from the outside in. Oh, I'm sorry. No, thaws from the outside in.
Yeah.
Inside out. So the outer layer starts to thaw first.
Yeah.
And in the center, you'll still have like a little ice cube of sperm. So it doesn't thaw as evenly and it doesn't thaw as quickly. I haven't worked with any other sperm banks in a number of years, but I do know, remember that when I used to use them, part of the process was using a water bath to warm them up or something of that nature to aid the thawing a little bit. So they don't recommend, I think, that you'd leave them sitting on a countertop. I could be wrong about that. I don't know. But in most of the laboratories I've been in, you know, it's always done in a water bath to warm it up versus laying on the counter.
Okay.
So the freezing and the warming of the sperm is both much more consistent and much more even with the straws.
Okay. So you take it, you open the canister, you take out the straw or the vial, and you thaw it according to the instructions, whatever they are. And it takes about 15 minutes or thereabouts. I guess it depends on whether it's a straw or a vial.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And then what do you do?
Well, then it depends. If you're using ours, it's because it comes in a straw, we have a little adapter that comes with it that connects to it in a syringe. And you'll cut the straw open with the instructions that are included. So you cut one end off, you attach the adapter to it, hook the syringe up, cut the other end of the adapter and draw the specimen into the syringe. Mm-hmm. And that can be a little tricky sometimes. You always got to make sure that you don't pull the end of the syringe out, but I hear that happening occasionally to people. But once you've done that, it's a pretty simple procedure. You have it already loaded in the straw. You just place it in the vagina as close to the cervix as you can, and you inject it very slowly into the vagina.
And so the idea is to get it as close to the cervix.
Exactly. Okay. So, and that's all included in our instructions. So you should be able to feel your cervix or close to it and get a good idea of where you want to get the syringe. And, you know, a lot of people have a partner doing it for them and they can get a little closer or wherever they want it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, I go back to the fact it's just reproduction. You know, we need to get the sperm in there and hopefully we'll have a baby. So it's hard to screw up a vaginal insemination in that regard.
Yeah, the sperm is programmed to know what to do at that point. So
yep, okay. That's exactly what sperm lives for. You know, it is programmed and it knows how to do its business. So,
so how many straws or vials should you buy if you are looking to inseminate per month? Because you obviously can't save it. Well, yep. That's let's be clear on that. Let's say you only use one. Can you then refreeze the other one? Stick it in your freezer?
No, keeping it in your minus 20 degrees freezer at home is not a good idea. it degrades the DNA content and a lot of things. So it's not a good idea to keep it in your freezer at home. It has to be at a much lower temperature than that. Mm-hmm. I think minus 80 would probably be the highest temperature you want to keep it at. We store it in liquid nitrogen, which is much, much colder than that. So you don't want to put it back in your freezer. That doesn't work very well. What was the question before?
How many straws or vials should you buy?
Okay. I can't recommend vials because again, they come with different numbers and different quantities. So our straws are half a milliliter straw. So you get a half a milliliter in each straw. We recommend that you buy two Mott 10 straws for an insemination. So twice or two straws.
And why two?
Well, we're a little different in that we recommend that they perform the insemination twice while they're ovulating. So when they first test positive and it comes back positive, we suggest that they do an insemination at that point in time. And then we suggest that they do one 12 hours later, that they do another insemination. And that's just to cover the window of opportunity, so to speak. Mm-hmm. When you start ovulating, we know the egg only lives for about 24 hours once it releases from the ovary. And so basically we have that 24 hours to work with, and we want to make sure that we get sperm in the right place at the right time to find the egg and do its mm-hmm. business. So mm-hmm. we're a little different in the fact that we are recommending that you do it twice rather than one time. And some of the banks do recommend that you only do it once. And that's where we go back to, there has not been a lot of studies in that regard. We just don't know. We feel that that's better. I can say that our Facebook followers feel that that's better, but mm-hmm. I don't have any conclusive evidence that says that is better. And believe me, we have looked for that evidence. We've tried to find that evidence either way. So, either way is fine, but we can't find the evidence that says one is better than the other, but we tend to lean towards the doing two inseminations versus one.
Well, when you are talking when you're talking about natural conception, couples are often encouraged to have sex twice during the ovulatory window.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Even when we
do IUIs in the doctor's office, we would, if the husband was able to produce his own sperm, we'd always encourage people to, re-inseminate when they go home. Don't just count on the one insemination. Go ahead and do it again. So mm-hmm. that's kind of the line that I'm taking too with doing the two inseminations.
Yeah, while not evidence, there is some support for it through natural conception.
Yeah.
Okay. So all of this doesn't sound all that hard or complicated. As you say, I'm smiling when you say it's just reproduction because, when you're in the world of infertility, just reproduction is like, oh, it's not just reproduction. If only it was just reproduction,
it's
but
just
I hear
reproduction.
You. Well, but I hear your point is that unless you've got, in this case, we're generally speaking of women who don't have fertility issues.
Right.
So then we fall into it's just reproduction.
Exactly. And I certainly don't mean that in any derogatory way at all.
No, none.
Because it's been my life making babies for people who couldn't have babies or being part of them having babies. But
absolutely.
It is just reproduction.
So are there instructions anywhere? Does YouTube have a video? So just so that when somebody is considering this, where would you send them to get some information to make it seem less strange?
Yeah, so there definitely are videos on YouTube. We also have videos on our website, cryosusa.com. There's plenty of videos on there regarding it. You can find all sorts of anything from medical aspects of it to people doing it themselves, just showing how simple it is to do it on their own.
Yeah. And when you look at some of the videos, honestly, it makes you so much less. It's like, oh,
yeah.
Okay. Is that it?
I've seen a few of them, I've looked at a few of them obviously, mm-hmm. and, watched, couples doing, inseminating, and it's very simple and it does put people's mind at ease. Certainly when they see mm-hmm. how easy it is, it's a good thing.
Would it be inappropriate to say it's not rocket science?
It is just reproduction.
It's just reproduction. All right. Thank you so much, Corey Burke. He's the Tissue Bank Director and Executive VP for Cryos International USA. Thank you so much for being with us today. This is a topic that I don't think gets discussed enough. And so I think for the reasons we've mentioned, we see more interest in it simply because people are younger and they have less fertility issues. So this is now an option for them, whereas in the past, because women tended to be older when they got around to donor sperm. So in that case, this really wasn't a viable option.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. Again, that's been a general trend in not just home insemination, but reproductive medicine in general.
Yeah.
We used to see a lot of older patients. That was primarily what we saw. And now it's, again, I said it before, but it's just, the world's changing, and it's a great thing.
Yeah, especially in reproduction, time is not on your side. So we really do want anyone to be thinking of sooner rather than later. So you're right, and we're seeing it in the donor sperm world as well. Exactly. Let me remind everybody that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to talk with your infertility professional. Thank you so much for being with us today, Corey and everyone else, and I will see you again next week.